Hello and welcome to the Money Nerds Podcast, where owning a calculator, budgeting your money, and having a net worth is actually cool. I'm your host, Whitney Hansen, and each week I'll be chatting with inspiring people to learn their secrets to financial success. Now let's dive into the show. Hey guys, welcome back to another episode. Tomorrow, oh my gosh, is Thanksgiving, which means Friday is Black Friday and the following Monday is Cyber Monday. So be careful with your budget. I tell you guys this with so much love. Be really, really careful. Don't go over your budget on buying crap. And after listening to this episode with Matt Terrio, I was even more motivated to watch my money even more closely so I can start doing additional real estate investing. It's awesome. You guys are going to absolutely love today's episode. If you want a little inspiration and some tips to surviving Black Friday and Cyber Monday, then go listen to last week's episode. That's where you're going to hear 7 tips to staying on track financially during the holidays. Okay, before we dive into Matt and all of his awesomeness, I wanted to share with you a really exciting money win. This one came from Chelsea. Chelsea says, "I finished paying off my credit card. It was only $1,000, but I still feel proud. Hashtag money win." Chelsea, I am incredibly proud of you. $1,000 is no small feat. That is so amazing. And most people, especially in America, can't even have enough money to cover a $1,000 emergency expense. So the fact that you paid off that credit card is so, so good. And you should be so proud of yourself. The important thing here is, yes, paying off your credit card is important, but the way you view your money wins, I think, is even more important, because even the language of "it was only $1,000, heck, I don't even care if it was $250. You should still celebrate that at the same level of excitement and passion as it, even if it were $250,000. It all matters. And I think it's the action and the step that really is important here. So I am incredibly proud of you. Congratulations on your money win. Guys, don't forget, if you want to join the private Facebook group, Manage Your Money Like a Boss, that's where I hang out quite a bit. And you can hang out with really amazing people that are also money nerds and supporting each other along their journey. It's a really great group, and I think you would truly love it. So it's Manage Your Money Like a Boss. You can just search it or click on the link in the show notes. All right, on to today's guest. Matt Terrio is a Marine Corps Desert Storm veteran. Total badass, right? He enjoyed 15 successful years in the music business as a record producer and label owner. When the digital download killed the record store, he found that he was basically everything that he'd built had become obsolete in just a few months. Can you imagine going through that? The demise of his music business was swift and unforgiving, and he had to start over personally, professionally, basically from square one at the age of 34. The transition from 7 figures a year to $7 an hour bagging groceries was incredibly humbling, and it really taught him quite a bit. So today, Matt is a real estate investor and a mentor, and has built cash flowing real estate portfolio of over 100 units over the last 10 years. He's enjoying his financial independence and continues to build his portfolio, and has discovered a new passion for creating systems and showing others how to replicate his success. In this episode, we talk about his fascinating background and what he learned from his work. We talk about the best advice he ever received, how he got started in wholesaling real estate, and how he actually made money doing that, if you've ever been curious what that process looks like, investing in his own properties, building up to 350 units at his peak, and things to think about when going from a duplex to a 40-unit property. Also, don't miss his answer to the last rapid-fire question at the end of the episode. It was spot on and maybe one of the best answers I've heard so far. Guys, I am so excited to introduce you to Matt Terrio from EpicRealEstate.com. Hey guys, welcome back to another episode. Today I am joined by Matt Terrio from Epic Real Estate Investing. Matt, thank you so much for hanging out tonight.
You bet. Thanks, Whitney. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm excited to chat with you. Your background is quite impressive. You've been in the Marines, you have been in the producing industry, music producing, and then you even started this real estate business. So what the heck, man? Where did you begin? How do you introduce yourself to strangers?
You forgot bagging groceries.
And bagging groceries, yes. We'll dive into that for sure.
Yeah. How do I introduce myself to people? I used to have a really great elevator pitch, and thank God I'm past that phase of my life where I don't have to prospect every single person that I talk to.
It's a good thing.
Yeah, no, it's a nice place to be. But you know, what we do over here is we help busy professionals build cash flowing portfolios so they don't have to work so hard. And that's the essence of what we do at Epic Real Estate.
I love that. Take us back to, it sounds like you had quite the pivotal moment when you were about 34 years old. What was going on right before 34 when your life started to change? What did life look like then?
Yeah, when I got out of the Marine Corps, I spent the next 15 years of my life in the music business, and I did really well for myself. And we had it's just myself and three of my buddies. We had a good little system going for selling music. We were in the world of independent hip hop. And so we never made the radio. We didn't make MTV. But we sold enough to create a really nice lifestyle for us. And we had a good little formula going every month. We knew we had to put out a record, and then we had a certain promo schedule to follow. And we knew that it created a pretty predictable income for us. And then one month that formula didn't work as well. And we were kind of scratching our head, like, what happened? And the next month we threw a little more money at it to try and make up for last month. And it worked even less. And six sequential months of that, we were out of business. I was bankrupt. I was, got divorced shortly after that. And then, you know, after going through the whole job market and finding out there wasn't a whole lot of demand for an out of work music entrepreneur, because there were a lot of us at the time, I ended up at the age of 34 bagging groceries. And it was a very humbling experience because I did not have a plan B. I thought I was set for life as far as what I was going to do with my life. And at the time it was happening, we didn't have a clue. I mean, at this point in hindsight, it's crystal clear what happened. But at the time, we had no idea. Mm-hmm. But that independent music fan, whether it was independent hip hop or it was independent rap or, I mean, rock or dance, they embraced that digital download before general public even knew what a download was. Hmm. And the habits of, or the, I guess the mannerisms of consuming music, it changed so quickly that people just stopped buying CDs and we were out of business just like that.
Man, that's scary stuff.
Yeah, it is. And it's something that I think about all the time moving forward now. I'm always on guard.
What did you learn from that? What was your biggest lesson?
I think I was really, I heard about the internet thing, mm-hmm. and I heard about the digital download, but I was just like, no one's going to change. People want to walk into a store. They want to smell the dust on the records. They want to hold the CD case in their hand. They want to read the bios and the notes on the album covers. And I just didn't think anyone would ever. I loved that experience so much growing up. I was like, how could you ever not do that? Mm-hmm. Like, it just seemed there was no emotion or no feel by just downloading a song and playing it digitally through some speakers. It seemed like it lost all its appeal. Mm-hmm. And, that's what I was thinking, and I think moving forward, I'll never say never again. I think I've really stopped being romantic about the way things used to be.
Yeah.
And I've stopped holding on to the way things used to be and recognize that the only thing that's not going to change is that things are always going to change. And so I embrace change now when I didn't before.
That's a really powerful lesson too. And I'm glad that you learned that. So I have to ask too. So how did you get into the music business? What was the draw there?
Oh, it's funny. I was born in a very suburb, a yuppie suburb in Irvine, California, in Orange County, before it was called the OC. And I was in a musical theater class in, I think it was eighth grade. This was back in 1983, 84. And we were doing a production of Flashdance, and the grand finale called for break dancers. So the instructor brought in a break dancer at the time and they taught myself and one other kid how to break dance. And when he brought in his big boom box and played the music, I just fell in love with the music.
That's amazing.
And that was the beginning. I never became a very good dancer, but I did fall in love with the music. I became a DJ and eventually a producer. And then I started producing records for my friends. And then I got a record deal and I started distributing and marketing. And then I became a talent scout. And,
nice.
And it just went from there. We had this small little independent label, but we had major label distribution by the time we were all done. And we were living the dream. It
That's
was great.
That's incredible. And you were how old then?
Let's see. I got my first paying gig, I think, when I was 17 years old.
Not bad, man.
As far as a producer. And then it was funny. At 17 years old, I got paid $1,000 to produce a record for Rodney O and Joe Cooley. I don't know if you ever heard of them.
Oh, yes. No way.
Yeah, they were my very first deal. And my very last deal, I think when I was 33 years old, was for $1,000. And I did that for En Vogue. And it's just like I came full circle from $1,000 in the beginning, and the market went to such crap that I got paid $1,000 on my very last deal.
Crazy. Wow, that is full circle. That's good way to close the loop, I guess. At least you made a little extra money at the end.
Yeah. I mean, I was used to adding an extra zero or two,
I can only imagine.
6 months earlier, but everything had changed.
Yeah, well, it sounds like for the best, too. So take us back to, as well, you joined the Marines. What mm-hmm. was the draw there? What was the decision behind that?
Oh, wow. We just keep going back and back.
I know.
All right. I was expecting to go the other direction.
We will. Don't worry.
Okay. You know what? When I got out of high school and I did my first year in college, and I was like, I am over school. I couldn't take it anymore. But I freaked out and panicked when I dropped out of college because I started thinking the worst case scenario. And I don't know where this came from. I've never had any threat or any, you know, experience with this, but I really had a big fear of being homeless. Hmm. And because I was 19 at the time, and I'm a technically adult. My mom hadn't kicked me out yet, but it felt like it could be just a matter of time. And I was really afraid to go out on my own. I was just really a scared little kid at that time. And I grew up without a dad, and it was just my mom that raised me. And I felt really wimpy and weak. Wow, I'm getting into psychoanalysis now and going back to school or going back to there. But I felt that if I joined the military, that I would always have a roof over my head and I would always have food in my stomach. Worst case, I would never be homeless. That was my logic at that age. Mm. And so when I went into the recruiter's office, feeling like the little wimpy person I was, not having a dad, I wanted to join the toughest one. I really wanted a kick in the ass. And that's how I ended up in the Marine Corps.
That's amazing. I think that gives us a lot of context to what motivates you and what drives you too. I think that's very interesting. So I appreciate you sharing that.
Mm-hmm.
So then now you're bagging groceries. You're 34.
Mm-hmm.
You're making $7 an hour. And how did you get into real estate? Where did you go from there?
Yeah, after about 6 months of bagging groceries, before it really hit me, before reality hit me, like, wow, if I don't do something, this is my future. And this is just totally unacceptable, having had a seven-figure year just the previous year before that. And I had a really bad day, and it was just, I had a bad attitude. And the grocery store manager, who happened to be the same age as me, he was also 34 years old. And he had been working there since he was 16, since he was in high school. And he was only 2 years away from pulling out 80% pension. Mm-hmm. So he's going to be 36 years old and being able to retire essentially with 80% of his salary. Mm-hmm. And so we were in very different places in life. And he shared with me, well, I'm going to quit in 2 years. And this is also what I've done along the way. I've been able to pull together these 6 apartment buildings in the last 20 years. And they're actually going to pay me more than what my salary pays in passive income. And he told me, he says, Matt, if you want your money back, and this quote, I'll never forget. I've repeated it countless times since. I think I've repeated it 3 times just today. And he said, real estate, it's the final frontier where the average person has a legitimate shot at creating real wealth. And at that point in my life, not knowing what was next for me, knowing I had to learn something new, knowing that I really missed my livelihood, I was like, well, if that's the final frontier, I better learn how to take advantage of that. And so that's how I chose real estate. It was all for the money.
That's it. How long did it take for you to truly internalize what that meant, that quote?
About 24 hours.
You were like moving on this.
Yeah, well, I'd had a darn near a nervous breakdown just a couple of days before that, asking God for a sign. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 2 days later, that seemed like, this is it. This is the sign. This is the final frontier. And God just showed me to it. And so it was a quick decision.
Okay. That makes sense. So then you started to get your ducks in row to purchase real estate. So did you start off purchasing real estate on your own, or were you like being a finder for people? How did that process go?
Yeah, the most people, when they don't know anything about real estate but decide that they want to get started in real estate, the natural tendency is to go get a real estate license.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I did. I had had an aunt that I hadn't seen in probably 15 years, but I connected with her over that night, and we had lunch the next day. And she happened to be the number one real estate agent just one city over, and I didn't even know it. And had lunch with her, and within 24 hours there, I was in school getting my real estate license, and I became a real estate agent without a whole lot of thought, just thinking like this is what I was supposed to do. I didn't know a real estate investor to guide me in the right direction to make it happen. And I was a real estate agent, did very well my first year. I got Rookie of the Year and did better each year after that. And about 4 years in, I'm a little bit of a slow learner sometimes. Sometimes it's fast, sometimes it's slow. And it was a Saturday, and I had these two clients that were, they were a team, they were an investing team. And they were my favorite clients because they just faxed me in paperwork and I processed it and I got paid. They were dream clients. Nice. And there was a Saturday where we were supposed to meet at the office. It was like 10:30 a.m. on a Saturday. And I show up in my suit and tie. I get all their papers laid out, ready for their signatures. And they show up 20 minutes late. They show up in jeans and a t-shirt. They sign the paper, and then they take off to enjoy the weekend. Now I'm stuck to process the papers. And then I got to go hold one of their houses open for the whole weekend. Mm-hmm. And that was one moment where I was like, you know what? I think if real estate is this final frontier where wealth is created, then I'm sitting on the wrong side of the desk.
Yeah.
And I made that commitment right there. Within 90 days, I'm no longer going to represent other people in their own transactions. I'm only going to represent myself and my own buys and my own sells. And so that was the big turning point.
That's amazing. So what was your first property?
I found a property. I made a fortunate decision. And looking back, I really dodged a lot of landmines. But I made a large investment in a real estate investing education program. And there was one class I was really attracted to called Creative Acquisition Strategies. And they had told me, just drive up and down streets, look for houses that look a little bit distressed, write the address down, come back, we'll show you how to look up the owner, you can contact the owner, and you can see if they want to sell. And so I did that, and the very first address I wrote down was a score, and I got under contract, and it was a single family residence that had looked like it had been abandoned, like someone started to rehab it but ran out of money and left the job half complete. And I took that property, got control of it, and found a money partner to come in and a handyman partner. Mm-hmm. And we turned that single family into a fourplex, and I put $26,000 in my pocket. That was my very first deal. And I was like, okay, this is what it's all about.
That's amazing. That was probably more than, or actually probably about the same salary for your bagging groceries job, right?
Yeah, it might have been even more.
I think it was. That's amazing.
I was like, I remember getting those grocery store checks. I was like, how does anybody live on this? Seriously. What are you?
It's rough. Just... It is very humbling. It's a good experience, but I don't think I'd want to do that long term either.
No.
So 26 grand you profited. Uh-huh. And then did you take the money and just immediately put it back into another property, or what'd you do there?
Well, I tried to repeat the process and started driving up and down streets, and I didn't strike a deal again for another 8 months. So that 26 grand was long gone. Yeah. And everything I had in savings was gone. And something that you kind of just touched on when you'd asked me how I got started, and that's when the real struggle began. And I guess not the real struggle, but the real beginning mm-hmm. happened. Was I got, you know, what do they say? Desperation is the mother of invention.
It is too.
And I could not find any deals the way that they're telling me how to do it. And I stumbled upon Craigslist, just going through there, looking, I was looking for all kinds of stuff, anything that presented opportunity. I didn't care what it was, mm-hmm. but it just kind of clicked. I was like, wow, we have a whole column here of people with houses for sale. And we have a whole column over here with people looking for housing. And I was like, what if I just start calling, creating some connections, find out what each person needs, and then try and play matchmaker. And that's exactly how I got started. And essentially looking back, I mean, I was wholesaling and didn't even know what wholesaling was. And now it seems to be a household term in my world. But I just found out what the sellers were looking for and what the buyers were looking for. And I found out a lot of the sellers were also buyers and a lot of the buyers were also sellers. And, you know, I played matchmaker there for, I don't know, a good year and made a very good living doing that.
That's amazing. I think most people would completely ignore that or maybe not even make that phone call because phone calls are scary for a lot of people. So did you hear no quite a bit when you were reaching out to buyers and sellers?
No, I didn't, because I wasn't calling to make them an offer. Mm-hmm. It was more about, okay, tell me about this property. And so what are you looking to get for it? And how did you come up with that number? Okay, great. I don't know if this is going to be a good fit for myself, but I might know somebody that'll be a good fit for. And if I happen to find that person, would there be room for a finder's fee in it from me? Hmm. So you never get a no to that question.
True.
Right? And so I never got no. So I just take notes of everybody I talk to. And then when I talk to a guy looking for a property, he says, okay, I don't think I have anything like that right now, not in my inventory, because I kind of played the role a little bit. Like I had a whole backyard full of houses.
Right.
Let me go dig through the rubbish and see which one I can pull out for you. And but I said, I don't think I have that right now, but if I find it, would it make sense for me to call you back? Oh, yeah, absolutely. And if I found that, would there be room for a finder's fee in it for me? Oh, yeah, of course. So I was able to put these deals together and pull finder's fees from both sides.
So smart, man. How did you charge the finder? Is that like a standard fee in the real estate industry?
Yeah, it was on the HUD at the time. I don't know how it would be noted now, because I don't even think we have HUDs anymore. I think they're called something else. It was marketing fee.
Huh. That's amazing. Yep. And yep. So that's how you got started. And then you started to purchase properties on your own. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So what happened, which I could have never imagined, and now it's something that I teach to my students and my clients, is just by being out there, what I would do is I'd take the one of the ways I would match people up is I'd take a property for sale on Craigslist. Once I got the confirmation it was okay to market the property, I got confirmation there was going to be a referral fee for me, I'd go make my own property flyer with their property. I'd put my own contact information on it, and then I'd go to networking events. I'd go to Chamber of Commerce. I'd go to the Kiwanis Club. I'd go to BNI. I'd go to all the real estate investor clubs. And at almost every single one of those networking events, there's always an opportunity where they say, will you please stand up, tell us about yourself and what you do?
Yep.
And I just had a really good speech for that. And I never went to any one of those networking groups without a property flyer. And I had a formula. It'd be my pitch, my elevator pitch. Then I'd focus on what's in it for them. And then I'd give them a call to action. And I'd be done in 60 seconds. And by doing that enough, I made good money doing it. But what happened that was even more valuable was I really created a reputation for myself in the community as being the go-to guy if you had a difficult property to sell or if you were looking for a special type of property to buy. And that type of activity that I was engaging in, it attracted buyers, it attracted sellers, it attracted lenders, it attracted partners, it attracted, you know, it just attracted money. Mm-hmm. And that was, I forget your original question, but that was the big benefit from it. Oh, and so as far as acquiring my own properties, I started having people come to me and say, I got 15 properties that I don't want anymore. Can you help me unload these?
Wow.
And I got 20 properties. And so that would happen every once in a while. And there was one particular person came up to me. I was in Los Angeles. And he had over 30 properties paid off free and clear, and he wanted me to sell them for him because he had seen me around, and he said he just kind of determined I was the guy. And I said, you know what? Would you be interested? Like, do you need all your money right now, or could I pay you for these over time? And he says, well, I need some money right now, but I would be willing to let, you know, I could take some of the money later. So what I did is I took this package of 30 properties, and I wholesaled half of them, gave him that money, and then he carried the balance on the rest.
Got it.
And that's how I built my first portion of my portfolio.
That's amazing. Okay, so if somebody's listening in and they want to do some type of real estate investing, maybe purchasing their first property, what mm-hmm. are their methods of financing? What are the common ones you see?
Well, I mean, there's the traditional way of the banks, right? A lot of hoops to jump through. Yeah. And particularly over this last decade, the guidelines have been pretty darn strict. So what I got really good at was when I would always deal with the private sellers themselves. Hmm. And they would say they'd want $100,000 for the property. And I would always have, depending on the situation, it might've been something like, well, do you need all of that right now? Could I give you some now and give you the rest later? Or it would be, great, that's a good price. I don't know if the market's going to bear it, but if I could get it, how many payments could I break that up into? Mm-hmm. And so I started asking those types of questions. Or another good question was, wow, $100,000 you're going to get for this property. That's a lot of money. I've got some money sitting on the side. I've been looking for a place to put it. I just want a good return. What are you going to do with yours? Mm. And they would say, oh, I probably put it in the bank or a CD. I was like, wow, a CD. Wow, I never think of that. How much are you going to get for that? Oh, probably 2%. And I'd be like, gosh, I don't know if this would make sense for you, but would you be open to 4% if it was secured by a real tangible asset? Oh, yeah. Where can you get that? And I'm like, great. So this is what we're going to do.
That's and, amazing.
Yeah. So that's how it was. Different approaches of getting the seller to carry back the paper.
I love that. I love it. And then you started to build up your portfolio more. 100, over 100 properties now. Is that right?
Yeah. I got to 350 units.
Oh, my heavens. How did you do that?
Just one property at a time. Like some of those was a 40 unit building. Another one was a 50 unit building. But all the same way, like you find that someone has a small little house for sale that they're trying to get rid of. And, you know, my favorite question at the end of those conversations was always, okay, so what else you got? Mm. And the people own multiple properties. And so I just started finding my way into different opportunities. And we got all the way up to 350 units. It wasn't 350 units performing. They're all in various states of repair, but some of them were such good deals I couldn't say no to. I just set them on the side and I'll get to these later. Mm-hmm. But about 2 months ago, not 2 months, excuse me, 2 years ago, we did an 80-20 analysis on the whole portfolio and just said, okay, which ones are performing, which ones are not, and which ones are performing, but they're a headache. Mm-hmm. And so we just started reallocating our assets and selling stuff, giving stuff away, and then taking profits and paying other stuff off. And we got up to 100 units. And so we had these 100 units, and then I really wanted to maximize the cash flow. So I kept 50 of them, and then I seller financed at a premium the other 50 to resident owners.
Got it.
So that really maximized my cash flow and minimized my management headaches.
That's amazing. So, okay, I've never owned definitely not 40 unit apartment complex. That's crazy to me. What's the difference between like managing a duplex versus like a 40 unit? What kinds of systems do you have to have in place?
Well, just the fact that you asked that question tells me that you might have had some experience with it before, because there is a big difference. And, you know, I really bit off a lot more than I could chew with these multifamily properties, thinking that, well, I own 40 single families. This is just like 40 single families underneath one roof. How difficult could it be? But it's a lot more difficult. It's like running a business inside of a business. It's not just taking care of a house and a tenant. And, you know, I took on some really big rehab projects with these multi-units. And so that was a whole other experience, dealing with contractors on that level of a rehab. And I didn't have a clue as to what I was doing. And I thought I was successful with 50 properties, single families. I mean, you know, it's time for me to graduate and be a big boy and go do something bigger. And, you know, I should have sought out some advice before I did that.
I can imagine it'd be a lot of phone calls. And I don't know what vacancy wise are the bigger units. Are they more vacant more frequently?
Yes. I also found a little bit lower. I don't know. How do I say this politically correctly? a lower grade tenant.
Yeah.
Where the roof over their head, their shelter wasn't necessarily their number one priority bill that they pay each month. Yep. So I had that issue. And then what really kind of pushed me out of that whole thing wasn't so much the property itself, but was the contractors I had to go through trying to get the property up to par. Mm. Yeah. My favorite saying now with all the experience I've got is like, real estate, it is safe. It is so safe. It is the safest investment anyone could possibly make. It's the people you deal with where the risk comes from. And I look at contractors and property managers, like every dime I've ever lost in real estate has been directly related to one of those two sources.
Interesting. That's good to hear. Something to watch out for all of us real estate investors out there.
Totally. Conduct as much due diligence on the people you work with as you do the property itself.
Oh, my goodness. Good advice for everyone, for sure.
Yep.
So with all of the real estate investing, knowing what you know now, what would you tell a beginner?
Buy more, sell less, and go really deep with your strategy. Go deep with your team. Go deep with your focus before trying to go wide. Would probably be the two biggest things. I would also be very intentional about creating your environment, particularly the people that you associate with. I think that could have a bigger impact on your results than anything. And once you're inside of that environment of doers, that people that are doing what it is that you want to do, seek out a mentor, seek out a coach. And if you can't find one, pay for one. I think the relationships, in hindsight, the relationships I've created, the relationships that I've been intentional about creating, have had more of an impact on my results than any other thing.
That makes perfect sense. And I think it's so cool too, because in today's world, we have so many amazing podcasts like yours, Epic Real Estate Investing, where people can go and learn years of experience and wisdom in 30, 40 minutes. And it's like already that saves so much time. So I think it's really cool that you share all your information with people.
Sure. Yeah. Mark Twain's got a quote that says, learn from other people's mistakes because you won't be here long enough to make them all on your own.
Mm. Amen like to that.
Right?
That's a very good quote. So Matt, I've had a really good time chatting with you and I love learning about real estate, but do you think you have some time for some rapid fire questions?
Sure. I love rapid fire questions.
All right. They're so much fun too. I always love people's answers. All right. So the first one, what is one purchase that you've made recently that's made your life better?
Ooh, wine fridge.
Oh, I like it. What kind of wine fridge?
I don't know, but it's a big one and it holds a lot of bottles and it's been amazing.
That's all we need to know, right?
Yeah, I've become a total snob because I'm very temperature sensitive now to my wine, which I never thought I'd be that person, but now I get it.
Congratulations, you've now leveled up.
Yep.
That's amazing. Okay, what's one location that you're dying to travel to?
Florida Keys.
Oh, me too. Funny.
Really?
Yes. Yeah.
Flip-flops, tank tops, margaritas just sounds like a total blast to me.
White sand. I mean, come on. Yep. It's perfect.
Totally. Right.
So from your perspective, what is the secret to financial success?
Place higher value on cash flow than you do cash itself. I think the streams of cash is what really produces the financial independence, financial freedom. Stop chasing the piles of cash. Stop trying to build the piles of cash. Focus on creating streams of cash. And it's not nearly as exciting. It's not nearly as glamorous, but it is a faster path, 10 times, in fact, faster to your financial freedom that most people are seeking.
Beautiful. Matt, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for hanging out.
You bet, Winnie. It was a pleasure.
Okay, what did you think? I love this episode with Matt. I thought his background was incredibly fascinating. And that was the piece that I thought was so interesting to hear, how he grew up, those decisions that he made, and how he essentially had to start all over at 34. When I hear so many 20-year-olds in my personal finance class at Boise State, I hear so many people say, oh my gosh, 34, so old. And the closer you get to 34, pretty soon that bar gets moved out a little bit further. But I thought that was so interesting to hear that at 34 years old, he was basically forced to start over from scratch and came at it with a great attitude and ultimately built an incredible business from that as well. So good things come from crappy situations, I think is a really good message from this episode. I would love to hear from you. What stood out to you? What was really the key moment for you where you were nodding your head and saying, yes, Matt, I fully understand. Screenshot your findings, let me know, and then share it with me on Instagram. Tag me in your story. Let me know that you're listening. It means the world to me, and I'd love to hear which pieces of this episode really spoke to you. That is it for today. Have an incredible Thanksgiving. Be safe. Watch your budget. And I will see you next week for another episode of the Money Nerds Podcast. Bye.